single Falcons, full Marlin rockets and everything. So nine of these things are attached to their booster. And when they go up, the second stage is actually one Falcon rocket that takes them to orbit. And when they go to MECO, main engine cutoff, that's the last of the Falcons, and then the Dragon takes over. We drop it on the rocket that they're working on now. Their goal is to recover the booster and actually reuse the booster. On the YouTube they show rockets taking off vertically, and it's a big rocket, and it takes off and it goes up for about 30 or 40 seconds, fly straight up, and then it starts to come back down. It's got landing gear on it, and slowly lands exactly in the same spot that it took off. That's the kind of control that this thing has. Their goal is eventually to recover that. Not only that, they want to be able to recover that second stage. Very important that all their rockets, including the ones on the Dragon, ones that misfired or weren't able to fire, are working correctly. But you got to remember, it's only going to be about 3, 4, 5 years from now they're going to be sending up astronauts on board this thing. He wants to get it right. Drop it. That's pretty much it. So, I won't continue on, John. Dick, let me turn it over to Ned. This is WS-1 space portion of the TechNet.
I don't know, boy.
Well done, Paul. 9 Falcons. I'm getting the impression because each of those Falcon rockets that are making one composite booster, and they're all connected to the main booster. At first I thought they must be solid state, but now I'm getting the impression that these 9 are liquid fuels, if they're able to come back in a controlled manner and land back where they started from. Can you imagine the degree of difficulty of getting 9 separate assemblies of liquid-fueled rockets all in the same countdown, all coming down to the exact same number with no glitches on any of the 9, plus the main one in the center, which is really 10. That is quite a feat. Am I misinterpreting this one, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
You have it right. I believe the fuel is a form of kerosene, liquid kerosene. It's not like a space shell liquid hydrogen, but the oxidizer is liquid oxygen. But it's a liquid fuel. I mean, it's probably similar to the Russian fuel. They run a kerosene type of mixture as well. So that's it. Now they have that's how they started off with their earliest flights. I think he had 5 flights with the single engine, and one failed right after the other, and then he was running out of funds. You know, he funded the whole thing himself, and stretching himself a little thin, Dick. But they showed the one rocket going off from, I think he left, it was launched from Kwajalein Island out in the Pacific, and it was quite successful. And then after that, then you put all 9 of them together, and you wind up with this Falcon 9 that he's using now. Very powerful rocket. And then, at the end of this year, this I gotta say, let me drop it. It's scheduled to go. It's called the Falcon Heavy. Well, the Falcon Heavy, it's comprised of 27 of these rockets. So you've got, it's really like 3, and that's what it looks like. It looks like 3 Falcons all put together. You got one in the middle, and instead of on the outside, you got these 2. Well, it looked like solid booster rockets from the shuttle days, but it wasn't really. really is two more of these Falcon 9s. It's got the heaviest lift capability of all the rockets, of anything going up from any country. It's got 58,000 pound capability of putting a payload into orbit. So we're talking about a big rocket. I mean, it's not as big as the Apollo, not the Apollo, the Saturn. Saturn 5 was, I think that was 7.1 million pounds of thrust, but this is up there. This is around, I think, a little over 5 million pounds of thrust. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
What a machine. The exoplanet that European Southern Observatory did make a picture out of, an optical picture, because it's so darn far away, 325 light years. I am guessing that's a pretty fuzzy picture that requires rather skilled photo interpretation to say that, yes, I see that exoplanet. My guess is it's not a real clear picture of a separate planet away from that sun. Is that roughly true, Paul? I wonder if you've seen the picture itself. Back to you, Paul. K2LAW.
Yeah, in that same article, I did see the picture. And, yeah, you're pretty much right. I mean, I can't tell it's a planet, but based on what they're looking at, they apparently can. And you know, I like the views that they show, you know, increased views, you know, square on top of square, you know, what you're looking at. You know, how the, it looks like you're zooming in. On what you're looking at and what they took a picture of. And it's just off to the side of this star. And I don't think it's a bright side. I think it's dimmer than the one of the ones that we have here on Earth. You can't see the star by your own eyes. You need to look through a telescope just to see the star. So I guess the magnitude probably is pretty, probably, I think it's pretty far up. Yeah, they had a rendition, an artist rendition of what it looked like. That's pretty good. Back to you, Jeff.
My guess is they used either more than one or maybe one really big telescope at the European Southern Observatory. And even that was probably combined in such a way that it was a sort of a coronagraph. In other words, you have to know out as deeply as you can the main star, because the planet itself is thousands of times dimmer than the star. So if the picture was exposed great enough to give you the planet, then you're hugely overexposed on the sun, and it floods out in light and obscures the planet. So I'm guessing it was a coronagraph, maybe even a pair of telescopes. You might mention that one.
Come down there, Dick.
What was that again, Paul?
It's not the one that they have. Don't they have the binocular set up there? I think it was the binocular one. I'm trying to remember the article. I don't write everything down, but don't they have a binocular one there? I'm trying to think of the diameter, too. I don't think they were too big. I thought it was like... Is that the place they have one? They have that down in Chile.
You've got it, Paul. They do have a binocular. A pair of side-by-side really big telescopes. And I think each one of them is something in the vicinity of 8 meters in diameter, the main mirror. That's 25 feet. So 25-foot diameter mirror, a pair of them, two separate telescopes side-by-side, a sort of a binocular setup. I wish I remembered the name of this darn thing. But I'll bet you that's what they had to use in order to resolve this exoplanet. And the fact that they can resolve it is good. It implies that it's a good-sized planet, a little bit normal than further than the normal distance to its local star. And I'm going to guess that we're not quite lucky for that to be one that's in the Goldilocks zone. So optically being able to view it is certainly representing progress. Am I correct in assuming that it's not one in the Goldilocks zone, in other words, just the right distance where liquid water is possible, you, Paul, K2RIW.
Trying to remember the article. I think that was out. They made a comparison. I think it was out by Saturn's orbit. So, pretty far away, but no way. That I'm looking forward to. Someday they'll have that. And I think your best chance will be with the James Webb.
Yeah, what's the latest on James Webb? Are they still predicting approximately 2018 for the launch date? Paul, go ahead.
Are they approximating? I missed what they were approximating.
The launch date for James Webb, is it still approximately the year 2018? Back to you, Paul.
It is, yeah, it's 2018, yes, that's the last I heard. So, somewhere, I think it's down in Texas somewhere, they're setting up a model of it, so people will be able to walk under it. They got a crane just to set up the model. This is as big as a tennis court. So, I mean, this thing is huge. Each mirror is roughly 3 feet, I think, or probably a meter. Hexagon mirrors, I think I use 36 of them. Comes out that, I think, the equivalent of like 21 feet diameter or something like that. Compared to Hubble's 8 foot, I think. I'm going by it. But yes, I think your Hubble's 8 and it's in around 21. So it's still the cost is phenomenal, but even with all the budget cuts, they're not cutting James Webb yet.
Yeah, this holding back of funds, I've forgotten the name that they use for it. I hope it doesn't affect James Webb. James Webb is an infrared telescope, which is going to give it the ability to penetrate gas clouds, really look at the birth of stars inside, get a better view of exoplanets and whatever. It's going to show us a lot of things. Now, in order to get the best possible sensitivity out of an infrared telescope, you'd like to have cryogenics. In other words, you'd like to cool your detector down to as close to absolute zero as you can get, like liquid helium, 3 degrees Kelvin. Do you know whether or not they're planning on liquid helium cooling? And if so, the liquid helium only has a finite life before you use it all up. So I wonder if we know something about the detectors and how long it's going to have full sensitivity. And if it is liquid helium cooled and you lose your liquid helium, you still have detectors, but now you're going to have a little bit more dark current, as they say. It's going to have not quite the same signal-to-noise ratio. Over to you on that one, Paul, K2RIW.
Yeah, liquid helium, but it only has a backup. It's really, that's what this whole tennis court size, you know, because the mirror is, you know, 21, 22 feet diameter. But below the mirror, this tennis court size sunshade, essentially, that's what it is. Five layers of some kind of maybe mylar type of material that's stretched out independent of one another, one layer after the other, stacked like phonograph records. But almost sort of rectangular in shape. And that part will be facing the sun. But between that and going out to L2, Lagrange point 2, Lagrange point 1 being between Sun and Earth, 1 million miles away from Earth. Lagrange point 2 being 1 million miles away from Earth, but away from the Sun. So it'll be in orbit around the Sun, 365 days. But as far as Earth is concerned, Earth will be turning every 24 hours in relation to to not only the sun, but to James Webb, which will be on the opposite side of the sun. So this thing's going to be looking out into space, taking pictures wherever it might be at that 365-point day. It might be looking at this group of stars or this constellation or whatever. As the years go by, they'll be able to revisit the same areas. Back to you, Dick.
Question, Dick. Yeah, I think I know where you're going to go, John. And I'm just suddenly realizing something. Those five shields on James Webb, between its mirror and the sun and the Earth, when you're in near-Earth orbit, you pick up a lot of heat from the Earth. When you're out in space beyond the Earth, you pick up a tremendous amount of heat from the sun. If you're at Lagrange Point 2, you're on the backside of the Earth, during certain portions of that orbit, it's going to wander around a little back there, but during certain portions of that, you're being eclipsed by the Earth. The Earth is between you and the sun, and a million miles away, yes, that is a total eclipse. So at times, it's going to be darkened by the shadow of the Earth, combined with the shadow created by the five heat shields. If your heat shields and the Earth do a good enough job, then all you see, all your electronics, will be at the background temperature of space, which is roughly 3 degrees Kelvin. That's cryogenic. So if your heat shields and the sun shadowing is thorough enough, you don't need any further cryogenics. Your electronics will automatically be at 3 degrees Kelvin, and you'll get full sensitivity. So have they mentioned the Earth's shadow during portions of that orbit in Lagrange Point 2, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW, and then turn it over to John. You got it, Paul.
I said the question, Dick. That was exactly what I was going to do.
I kind of thought we were thinking alike. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, that's the one of the main reasons to keep it so far away from Earth. They need to keep that location because it stays there almost by itself. There is some fuel because everything at Lagrange Point 2 will pretty much stay there, but it does need some fuel to kind of move around a little bit here and there. They call them halo orbits out there. So a lot of portions, most of the portions of time that you're going to be eclipsed by the Earth, but it tends to wobble and get away a little bit away from the Earth. But with that sun shield, they're going to be down to proper temperatures because you got to remember, it is an infrared telescope. We're not going to get pictures or anything. Well, no, you're going to have perfect pictures. Just in the infrared light version.
That's going to be a fun project. And no way is that ever going to come back to Earth. One of the things we were discussing last week or the week before is bringing things back to Earth. And what we all forget about is that when something is in near-Earth orbit, like the International Space Station, or where you used to put the space shuttle, numbers like 180 miles up, where you're just barely skimming the top of the atmosphere, all you got to do is a little bit of a retro rocket burn, something in the vicinity of 250 feet per second. There's a rule of thumb that NASA uses. If your spacecraft is less than 500 miles of altitude in Earth orbit, every 2 feet per second that you change your velocity changes your altitude 1 mile. Ain't that crazy? You're in orbit around the Earth. You're in low orbit, low Earth orbit with the space station, with the Hubble, space shuttle. You're flying 17,500 miles an hour. That's something like 25,600 feet per second. 25,600 feet per second. You do a little bit of a burn, retro burn, to slow yourself down by a couple of hundred, like 150 miles an hour, 270 feet per second. That lowers your altitude on the far side of the Earth down to 60 miles when you were at 160 miles. So now your calculated orbit on the other side of the Earth when you do that burn is 60 miles high, which puts you way into the atmosphere. You start getting atmospheric drag, and you come home if you planned it correctly. Can we drop? So it takes very little burn when you're just skimming the top of the atmosphere to bring you in the atmosphere, you get that drag, and you come home. Okay? Now you go up to medium Earth orbit, 10,000 miles, or synchronous orbit, 23,000 miles, 24,000, something in that order. Now, in order to get down to the atmosphere, it takes a huge difference. The amount of boosting power you took to get up there to geosynchronous orbit is almost the amount of retro burn boosting you need to come home. It's so far above the atmosphere, you've got to burn up all that energy that got you up to that altitude. As such, nobody arrives in synchronous orbit with anything like the booster that got them there in the first place. So that really shows you how we're never going to bring anything back that's in synchronous orbit, 24,000 miles up. It's going to go to the graveyard eventually, up, and the graveyard is up. As such, repair missions up there, any kind of hardware you send for doing repair is a one-way mission. By definition, you're not going to send a man. However, you look at some of those beautiful YouTube videos of what Dean Kamen is doing. He's the guy behind these competitions where the students are building these robots. And he himself has been building hand-like manipulators. He's been making the robot equivalent of a human hand. And he's been doing it for the disabled veterans. Let me drop it. But if you got the right kind of a robot as a remotely piloted vehicle designed by Dean Kamen, NASA and Kamen have got to get together. As such, they can build a repair mission, you give it a whole lot of fuel, you bring it up to geosynchronous orbit, you reservice 2, 3, 4 geosynchronous satellites, you give them some fuel. You know, you and I have watched what Story Musgrave and other Musgrove and other astronauts have done when they're doing a Hubble repair. They're doing all kinds of hand-eye manual manipulations of hardware, doors, strapping devices to bring the doors together. They're doing a lot of human operations. A Dean Kamen-designed robot could do every one of those by remote control, and the fact that it's a one-way mission and it's not going to come back is perfectly all right. I mean, we're going to lose a drone every so often, if you know what I mean. And so, therefore, repair missions by that process are possible. I am guessing, Paul, it's only a matter of time before NASA comes to that conclusion. It may cost you 400 megabucks to put a geosynchronous satellite up there. It may take you 10% of that to send up a repair mission to refuel it. And therefore, I think you're getting your money's worth, particularly if that repair mission can refuel and repair a couple of them and bring them back to life for another 5 or 10 years. You see the economics on this, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely. And all those satellites out there, they really weren't designed to be refueled, although they do have the capability now of doing exactly that. They've experimented on the International Space Station. A couple weeks ago, where they ran a test with a robotic design called Dexter. He's outside the space station. He's able to take a unscrewed cap, duplicated by putting a nozzle of not antifreeze, ethylene. Glycol, like a glycol mixture, and it will actually pump that in, put a cap back on, closed valves, open valves, and not done by the astronauts, but on the space station, being done by, just like you said, mission control, people operating the equipment, dropping. There was a big push for this, again, I think we talked about this too, for the Hubble repair mission, the last one that was scheduled after Columbia burns up over California and Texas. We lost quite a few years, and during that time frame, there was a big push big development on remote control robotics. I don't think they had so much autonomy where they could work alone, but like you said, have somebody on Earth or even on a space station operating manual gloves, which duplicate what they're doing in space. And you can see down in the space station, they have a robot on in the space station, and it's being controlled, and you see the guy's hands moving, and you can see the robot's hands moving. They actually have one up there. It was built by GM. So, not too far away, but we'll be able to do just what you're saying. And you'll lose a couple of robots. Who cares? You're 100% right. But it's a lot better than building a new $300 million spacecraft that you can put out in geosynchronous orbit.
You've got it, Paul. In the case of Curiosity, the thing that most recently landed on Mars, at Mars Science Laboratory, doesn't quite have a robot on board, but with all of that manipulation capability of that drilling device that got out in front, it's really got a wrist, an arm, an elbow, all kinds of tools on the end of it. It can burn holes in rocks, drill holes in rocks, gather the dust, put it inside the laboratory and measure it. All of that control is being done from 300 million miles away at Mars. If we can do that kind of control from 300 million miles away, up to synchronous orbit of 23,000 miles, that's easy. Very little time delay, very little latency in the control, if you know what I mean. Just build the right kind of robot. It's just a matter of time. And therefore, you put a lot less lives at risk. To put a man on the International Space Station and run a bunch of experiments and to see what happens to long periods of weightlessness and the effects on the human body, we're getting a lot of knowledge out of that. But you never want to put a human being at synchronous orbit. And I'm even a little bit skeptical that we're, in your and my lifetime, Paul, going to have a colony on the moon. Let me drop. Yeah, if you build a real good optical telescope, a real good radio telescope, and put it on the backside of the moon, it can do some real good work. But does it have to be manned by human beings? To put a human being on the moon for a long period of time is a lot more difficult than you think. Yeah, on the Apollo mission, we sent men to moon. But the resources required to supply that man with air, food, water, warmth. They were there for an extremely brief period of time. Had they dwelled any longer, when you go from sunrise to high noon on the moon, where the temperatures go up to boiling temperatures of water, or you go from high noon to midnight, where you go way below the freezing temperatures of dry ice, so to speak, the moon goes through some wicked temperature changes. So at the equator of the moon, you're never going to put a human being. Maybe at the pole in an equator that gets shadowed and you give them the right kind of a furnace to stay warm, so to speak. But to maintain a human being, the resources required are a lot more than we realize. Earth continuously supplies oxygen, air, carbon dioxide, water, air pressure, gravity. You take away all of those things, put a man in space, you've got to go through heroics to keep him alive. Even if he's in hibernation, it takes a lot of a human being at rest. Let me drop. A human being at rest is continuously consuming energy about the equivalent of 150-watt incandescent light bulb. If you're designing the air conditioning system for a great big theater, and you want to know how much air conditioning you need, and you've got 1,000 people in that theater, and each one of them is giving off 150 watts of heat. If he's sitting still, and if it's a concert where he's jumping up and down and hollering, he can easily go to 300 watts of output, each human being. I think I told you guys the story that I'm sitting at Yankee Stadium because my brother just loves the Yankees. And he and his buddy own a box seat. And I'm sitting in the box seat, and I watch this bird fly over Yankee Stadium on a summer day. And I watch the bird rise about 100 or 200 feet without even flapping his wings because of the hot air
coming off Yankee Stadium. And the sun was at a very shallow angle, so there was very little sunlight was coming into Yankee Stadium. That heat of all that rising air was coming from all of those people sitting in those seats. Human beings consume a lot of energy. And if you don't supply it, they starve, go to sleep, go into hibernation, and soon die. So maintaining a human being off of planet Earth ain't easy. I wonder if any of the articles you've read say anything along these lines, Paul. I think they're not, because NASA likes the fact that every high school student is dreaming about the fact that his generation is going to have an astronaut standing on Mars. I doubt it. Back to you, Paul, from S2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, well, things happen too slowly for me, so. I mean, while back in 67, I guess it was, I saw the 2001 Space Odyssey, I figured we were going to have at least one, maybe two space stations that were up there spinning with artificial gravity. Definitely colonies on the moon. Well, when that didn't happen, and it got to around the 80s, and I got my ham license, I said, well, this is pretty cool. I'm getting QSL cards from all over the world. And I said, it's not going to be too long that I'm going to have a QSL card being sent by somebody that's stationed on the moon. Because, you know, back in, you know, you got to remember, 1980 or so, we've already had 12 people walking on the moon. And it was only a matter of time before we went back. Well, here we are. We're going into 2014, and it doesn't look like that's going to happen anytime soon. Let me drop it. And anything I've read, I mean, they want to eventually have people stationed probably on the south pole of near Shackleton crater, and they'll be able to get minerals and water and all that in the crater. I think this is going to take a little time. And could you imagine staying on the moon? I mean, all those flights that we sent up there were all scheduled. You know, there was a window. Part of that window was that the sun was shining on the moon. Could you imagine being an astronaut sitting on the moon during the new moon phase? Dick, for that couple of weeks, it would be a couple of weeks, I think. A month for the complete cycle, 28 days. So you're looking at 14 days of pretty much all darkness and cold. You better bring some, you can't use solar panels. You better have those RTGs up there with you. Back to your Dick, WS2N.
My guess is you have not seen any future proposals from NASA that mention colonization of the moon. I'll bet you that's very conspicuous by its absence these days. Am I correct on that, Paul? You've seen no predictions that in 5, 10, 15, 20, 25 years, NASA says we're going to start planning for putting a colony of human beings on the moon. I think that's, I'm guessing they're very quiet in that area at this time. What do you think, Paul? KQLAW?
NASA's very quiet. I've never heard them say that they had actual plans of going ahead with the colonization. Oh, they've talked about all the different, you know, the next generation, the Orion constellation system, designed for the new lander and all, four people at a time. But, no actual talking of now colonizing. Hopefully, maybe setting up some kind of deal down by the South Pole. A lot of the sun tends to hit there all the time, so most of the time. It's not as dark. The equatorial part, there was some talk of that, but there were never any real big plans put into it. Mostly by private concerns. For instance, Elon Musk, he
made a speech that in Europe stating he wants to send, let me drop it, 80,000 colonists to Mars by, some period of time. I've heard a lot of private corporations, people talking that they want to do things like this. But nothing serious out of NASA. Google, I mean, it's a sort of related, it's not people, but they're willing to pay $20 million. To me, it doesn't sound like a lot of money, but what he wants to do is he wants to pay $20 million as an award for the first company that could send any kind of a craft, land it on the moon, have a rover drive around. They want to be able to go 500 meters, about 1,500 feet or so, and send back, not bring back, but send back high-definition pictures of whatever this little rover is looking at. And there's also a second-place prize. In fact,
is that one of these X prizes? And I think you said Moon, not Mars. In other words, if you send a commercially made, not NASA-made or government-made craft to the moon and then drive around 500 meters and send back high-res pictures from the lunar surface. Now, to go to the moon with the right kind of laboratory-like thing, just like Curiosity, to scoop up the materials, to drive around, to drill holes in the rocks, to make measurements, and maybe even bring some stuff back home, I can sort of see that. But I don't see very much value in putting a human being there for a long period of time. Yes, a human being is a little bit more adaptable, and you're going to get your data as to the scientific measurements he makes a little bit faster. That's the good news. But the huge investment it takes to maintain a human being in that environment doesn't strike me as being cost-effective. Back to you, Paul. KQLIW.
No, it's not really, but as far as raising money, then it does become cost effective. We wouldn't be where we are today if we didn't have a manned space race. I've gone through this before where without it, you wouldn't have the robotic missions that you have today. You could, if you put that same money into it, you'd have what we have, plus more. The money wouldn't have gotten there. The momentum created after the moon race gave you missions like Viking to Mars, two landers that landed on Mars, two orbiters from the same light orbiting Mars, gave you pioneer missions past Jupiter. Got the Voyager missions now out in the heliosphere, you know, three times the distance of Pluto. These missions wouldn't have even occurred, I don't think, without the manned space mission. So again, if you set up some kind of a manned space station, a manned space program to the moon, or even Mars, people get excited about it. The taxpayers more willing to pay for that than just another scientific probe going somewhere. And, what's good about it is now the money is there, and you can get the scientists can get their data. But the money is now there because of manned missions. So in that respect, that's what it does. And of course, there's some good to it. You know, once you get there, you can do a lot of work with people. But cost effectively, I think you're going to be better off with robots.
Something else happened to me in the last week and a half, Paul, that shocked the daylights out of me. I've heard hints of this before, but now it's getting to become really real. As all of these beautiful telescopes for low, medium, and high portions of the electromagnetic spectrum are created on Earth in very desirable locations, as you put up space hardware like Hubble and James Webb and others, as you learn more and more about what goes on in the solar system, galaxy, galactic group, universe, multi-universes, but slowly shifting, becoming more and more humble as to how little this whole thing was created just for our benefit. I mean, we're there, but the what is a hell of a lot of other stuff. And let me show you where I'm going on this one. By your and my standards, the Earth is pretty big. And if you look at the number of zeros you have to put just to tell you the weight of the Earth, it's a pretty big number. And you add up all of the planets. Jupiter is, I don't know how many thousand times bigger than the Earth, but it's big. But then you add up Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and I'm going to count Pluto, as well as Mercury, Venus, and Earth, and Mars. You add them all up. Huge number. But that's only 1% of the mass of the Sun. So the Sun is really heavy and big. Almost a million miles in diameter, and really heavy, even though it's a great big puffy glass cloud, if you know what I mean. And it would take three suns, three times the solar mass, so that at the end of life it could become a black hole. So our sun has got too little mass to become a black hole. So we're now discovering that in the middle of almost every galaxy there's a black hole. Okay. So a black hole has got to be a minimum of three solar masses. And you eventually see evidence that you find some black holes that are 10 suns, 100 suns, 1,000 suns. And even that's hard to imagine. Something as heavy as the sun, 1,000 times heavier, that's called black hole. You do a little bit more searching, you'll find 10,000, 100,000, and a million suns. Now it's getting hard to accept. How can something get that big and that heavy? You do a little bit more searching, and you'll find out there are some black holes that are 10 million, 100 million, a billion times as heavy as the whole sun and solar system. A billion times. Okay, the latest discovery is that, yes, each galaxy has a black hole in the center, and on average, the black hole is 0.1% of the mass of the whole galaxy. So a black hole, 0.1% of the mass of the whole galaxy, a black hole of that mass in the center, holds it all together. All of a sudden, they found this slightly small galaxy where the black hole in the center is not 0.1%, it's 14% of the mass of the galaxy. How the hell did a black hole get to be that big a percentage? And this is a relatively small galaxy. Oh, by the way, that particular black hole is 17 billion solar masses. Out of sight. 17 billion times heavier than the sun is the black hole in the center of this medium-small galaxy. Did the black hole get that big because it's slowly eating the whole darn galaxy? It's a very mature galaxy, by the way. Can you imagine what would happen if some of those supermassive black holes, 17 billion, by the way, is the biggest one they've discovered to date. This is in one of the latest issues of Sky and Telescope or Astronomy. It's the March or April issue, which I bought on the newsstand. And this is just one of those small articles there. 17 billion solar masses. Let me drop. Yeah, I'm going to pass it to you in the middle, John, in a second, John. And because there are so darn many of these things around, obviously, although it may be a rare event, can you imagine if a pair of them came together? We know that every so often you see a gamma ray burst. Gamma rays are the most intense radiation you've ever seen, and every so often you'll see one of those that represent an amount of energy of a whole galaxy, 100 million stars, all going supernova simultaneously. That's the amount of energy in a gamma ray burst. And you see one of them per month. Each galaxy, on average, has one of them per 100 years. And if one of them happens within 22 light years of where you are, it'll cook everything on Earth, boil away all the water, kill all the animals and all the plants and whatever. Mother Nature can do some awfully violent things. There appears to be almost no limit. Whatever gamma ray detector you put out there in space, you try to make a measurement of how strong these things are. No matter what you put up, just a matter of time before something comes along that will saturate it. and you didn't make a measurement. All you know is you pegged the needle. Go ahead, John. Think big. KC2WGV, KQLAW.
Exactly, Dick. Something new this week, I believe it was on the Discovery Channel, about the universe, that rogue planets, which happened with our solar system when Jupiter threw two planets out, because originally we had like 100 planets and now we're down to the 8 or 9 that we have now, they were just thrown out of the influence of our sun, and they're just wandering around. Well, now the mathematicians have figured out there could be as many rogue planets as we have stars in this galaxy. Now, how about that? And some of them are the size of Jupiter, some are much smaller, but they're just flying around, unrelated to any star. That's a scary thought.
And although it's a rare event, maybe only once per 60 million years, one of them come crashing into the Earth, and you're going to have a mass extinction. This Earth that we're living on has already had 5 mass extinctions in its history. Once every, let me pick a number, 100 million years, something comes along, crashes into us, creates a nuclear winter, and you put so much dust into the atmosphere that all the sunlight gets reflected back into space, everything freezes, all the plants and animals die, and you start all over again, and everything slowly calms down. And we ain't got no defense for that. This thing that went whizzing by a week or two ago, thank goodness it missed us, came inside of the synchronous orbit. Had that hit, I think it would have been, what was the number? 100 million, 100 megatons or 500 megatons of equivalent to megatons of TNT, a really big nuclear blast, equivalent. That tiny little thing that hit in Russia and injured 1,200 people and broke a hell of a lot of windows. That was a tiny little object. So, where were you reading this, Paul? And how soon is one of them going to get us? I said Paul, I meant John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Yeah, look at the odds, Dick. We've got basically 100 million stars, and if we have anywhere near their projection, 100 million rogue planets, and these are, I mean, they're not even moon-sized. They're mostly bigger than the moon. What do you think the chances are? And how many galaxies do we have? I wonder, do they ever get thrown out of a galaxy? Are they drifting in space itself? We can't see them because they're dark, but there's 3 scientists that are working on this problem, and they're really worried about it. I guess we have no defense against that, that's for sure, except we got to move.
And Johnny got 100, minimum 100 billion, 100 billion stars in our galaxy.
That's right, 100 billion, so figure 100 billion planets roving around. Oh my God.
Yeah, that's 10 to the 11th. It's a really big number, just for an average-sized galaxy. And they got bigger ones and smaller ones, but maybe you're seeing part of the missing mass. As you know, there's only a few percent of the mass of the universe do you see with your telescope, so to speak. There's a whole lot of dark matter that we don't see, and an even bigger amount of dark energy that's creating mass by some mysterious procedure. As you know, I'm convinced that dark energy really is that force which is creating the accelerating expansion of our universe, of our galaxy. I'm convinced that, our universe, I'm convinced that because of the multiverses out at the perimeter, the stuff is being attracted to those other universes that we don't see. There's multiple universes. We're about to have the fifth or sixth humbling of mankind. Boy, we've stepped down and stepped down a whole lot of times. We ain't the center of the solar system. We're not the center of the galaxy. We're not the center of the observable universe. We're not the center of anything. And And we think that the universe we see is the only one. Guarantees us more of them. There's a step and repeat in bigger and bigger terms, no matter where you go, no matter how you look at it. For us to suddenly say that the last step up to what we think is the size of the universe, and that's the end of it all, and you take a Hubble deep field, an ultra deep field, an extreme deep field picture, and you see thousands of galaxies you never knew existed at greater and greater distances and greater redshifts, and you think you're seeing the edge, not a chance. As you go out to that edge, you think that the density is going down, it's not. There's a lot more.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
There's enough. There's a lot more stuff out there beyond our visual range. I'm going to pass it back to Paul and John in that order. What's your feeling on multiverses? What's your feeling on what we see? Is that all there is? There's a song about that. Is that all there is? WS2N, K2LIW. What do you think, Paul?
I think if you like that topic, you've got to get a book by Brian Greene. I know you've seen him. Greene, G-R-E-E-N-E with an E at the end. And his latest book is really good. It's The Hidden Reality. He's the author of The Elegant Universe and The Fabric of the Cosmos. But I've read them too. But Hidden Reality is really good. All about the multiverses and it goes on and on. It's very well done. So if you need some time, it must have taken me a year to get through that book there. Dick, I don't have the time for this. Very well done. He's really got it together. And he explains a lot of theories that get away from people. I like one theory about the width of the universe, 45... 45 billion, no wait, they say 16.7 billion years, light years, of course, but yet they come out with 45. He explains where they get that number very well in that book. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, well, the time is 13.77 billion years. But the real distance that you're not seeing is something like 45 billion light years. And because these extremely fast expansions are taking place at the same time that you're sitting here and looking what light is getting to you. There's a hell of a lot of distance out there where the light hasn't gotten to us yet. We ain't seeing it all. Have you been running into articles and books like this, John? Are you starting to feel a little bit humble? KC2WGB, K2LIW. Although those guys in Staten Island, I think maybe they know where it's. Maybe that's where the center of the United States really is. Back to you, John.
Oh, I know for a fact this is the center of the universe. In fact, right in my room here, because I can see everything from here. But you know, I think our own arrogance sometimes prevents us from seeing what could be possible. And I believe you're right. There are a few astrophysicists that claim there's a group of galaxies that are headed out in a direction that they should not be traveling. They believe it's the force of another universe that's causing it. So I believe in the multi-universe. Absolutely, Dick. I agree, and I think it's very arrogant for us to deny it. Back to you, Dick.
Just because you don't see it yet doesn't mean it's not there. Picture what happened around, 1850 or so, when somebody was coming up with the germ theory of disease. That people were coming up with a theory that cells, molecules, atoms, bacteria, and viruses, which they hadn't even invented the word yet, just talk about them. Bacteria. All of these things that make disease is way beyond the limits of what the eye can see. There were people coming up with theories like that in the 19th century, 1800s. And of course it was hard to believe, and a lot of people said, bull. That's just crazy. And as you started developing better and better microscopes and better and better methods of detecting disease, and found out how disease is spread and what cleanliness is really required to stop it from spreading, with the antiseptic techniques and so on, early physicians, some of the things that they used to do, let me draw a the things that physicians used to do in the late 1800s in hospitals where a woman would go because she was about to give birth, the things that they used to do then by modern standards of good hygienic techniques make you say, wow, is that horrible? What ignorance there was in those days about the germ theory. Until you could really see it under a microscope and take pictures, the majority said it doesn't exist. Here we are now saying multiverses, there's a lot of evidence they almost have to exist. There's essentially one way that they don't exist, and there's a zillion ways that they do exist. They got to exist, even though you haven't seen them. There's a lot of evidence that that accelerating expansion, from my point of view, is a very strong piece of evidence. And there's going to be more evidence as time goes on. And that missing mass and missing energy and whatever. We ain't seen it all. Just like when we study radio, we study electronics, we study chemistry, no matter what you study, physics, even math, if you think it's simple, you don't understand the problem. The fun I have with some guy, let me drop it. Some of the pretty scientific guys I've worked with from time to time, I'll say, hey, John, assuming the guy I'm talking to is named John. Hey, John, give me an example of something that's simple. I mean, a lot of the non-engineering people we work with give us a lot of flack because they say, you engineers, you're worried about the fine details. You're scared about everything. You slow down every process. You're worrying about all this stuff when Mother Nature is really simple. I say, oh, yeah? Give me an example of anything you can think of that Mother Nature has set it up in such a way that mankind has studied it, we understand it, and it's simple. Give me an example of something that at the real base level you think is simple. Pretty soon they slowly come to the conclusion, ain't nothing simple. You can't easily choose something that's simple. It probably doesn't exist. If you think it's simple, you don't yet understand it. Nothing was set up just to be simple and easy for mankind to understand. I don't think we've been favored. I don't think the big intelligence, wherever it is, even knows about us yet. How are you, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
I agree. I've never... that was easy.
QLBY? Hello, 1-2. Yeah. I was here, Paul, on the input, and I heard everything you said, Paul, but I think your signal doesn't quite get to Staten Island, so John, I just wasn't hearing you, and I'm coming in by an alternate means. 73 UWIs. This was TechNet number 1440. We'll be back next week. Be kind to each other, and we'll slowly figure out a little bit more about what we don't know. It shows here. Who is it that just signed in? K2LDY.
And QLDY.
Relay, there's been a station trying to break or get your attention. N2RDL. N2RDL is trying to get in.
I'm hearing N2LDY, and is it also an RDL? LDY, go right ahead. K2LIW.
Oh, okay. Thanks, Dick. You know, just if you hear me, just a little question closer to home here, or closer to this. I took my telescope out the other night. It's a Meade Cassegrainian type. The baffle, the secondary baffle was loose, so I like re-epoxied it up there. but my question was, have you ever cleaned the optics, the front surface mirrors